broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on today's programme, against all the odds and in the wake of the shock referendum defeat last month, the peace deal between the Colombian government and FARC rebels passed through the Senate yesterday, and it looks set to do the same in the lower house of Congress today. We'll be looking at the practical realities which now face the fragile accord.
MPs in the British Parliament are today debating whether Tony Blair misled Westminster in the run-up to the Iraq War. The motion has been proposed by the former Scottish First Minister, Alex Salmond. We hear this hour from one of Blair and the Iraq War's most fervent cricket critics, former Respect MP George Galloway.
Tensions remain high among the senior leadership of the African National Congress after their National Executive Committee rejected calls for President Jacob Zuma to stand down as South African president. But serious questions remain over Zuma's leadership, as Professor Tom Lodge, Professor in Peace and Conflict Studies at Limerick University, tells World in Focus.
Scenes in Haiti as banana exporter and political newcomer Jovenel Moïse wins the presidency amid claims of foul play and electoral coups. We'll be looking at the controversial new Haitian president and who he is and what it means for Haiti.
As officials and dignitaries from around the world converge on Cuba, the president of Sinn Féin, the Irish Republican Party, describes the mood in Havana and recalls his previous meetings with Castro, as well as comparisons between Ireland and Cuba.
And it's St Andrew's Day today, Scotland's national day. But why has the projection of the Scottish flag caused such a fuss today?
All that and more coming up on today's edition on Wednesday of World in Focus. The peace process in Colombia took another major step forward yesterday as the Senate voted 75 to none to approve the revised peace agreement between the Colombian government and the FARC rebels. The lower house of Congress will consider the measure today, which comes in the wake of the previous accord's referendum defeat in October. And it's that narrow defeat that's causing opponents of the deal to complain that this is anti-democratic, with the figurehead of the No campaign, former President Álvaro Uribe, arguing that only a second referendum would give the decision legitimacy.
President Santos was upbeat following the Senate vote, saying that the government was, quote, committed to the peace we long for, whilst the government's lead negotiator, Humberto de la Calle, called the peace process fragile and said that this was a, quote, crucial moment for Colombia. Proponents of the accord are hopeful that this will finally draw to a close an era of violence in Colombia, which has claimed over 220,000 lives and displaced millions more.
Dr. Andre Gomez Suarez is from the Department of Social Prosperity of the Colombian government at the University of Sussex, and he joins me on the line now from Bogota. Thank you for speaking with us today, Dr. Suarez. Now, given the sizable opposition that still exists in Colombia, how easy is this going to be to implement in practice?
Well, yeah, I think that's a really important question, because the problem that we have now is that you have a majority in Congress willing to accept the peace deal between the government and the FARC. But what is happening in the regions is that you have violence spreading against social and political leaders in the regions. So in a way, what you are going to get is a really complicated context in which a small sector of the political elite would be against the peace deal, but also on the ground in the regions of Colombia, you have violence spreading against people who they regard close to the FARC. And that's going to be a really complicated scenario, but I think that the willingness of the FARC and the Colombian government would actually prevail, and the implementation would take place in a slower pace, but that would be the way forward.
What about the various elephants in the room? I mean, and you alluded to them sort of there, i.e. the remnants of right-wing paramilitary organizations which have technically disarmed, and other guerrilla groups that were not involved in this peace deal. Is there any reason to be concerned about where they might go from here?
The thing with paramilitary groups is that the government has been trying to get a deal with them, but it's going to be a different one because what they've been offered is the possibility of surrendering and getting different sentences. But there is not a political negotiation as such. This is something that is been going on for some months now. However, with the vote in the referendum on the 2nd of October, there was like a sort of raising up of legitimacy for a right-wing struggle against leftist movements. And that's the reason why these talks have been halted. Now, on the side of the other guerrilla groups that you're talking about, mainly the ELN, well, the ELN negotiation with the government depends on the ELN releasing one of the people who had been kidnapped for the last 3 months. And I think that the strong support that the peace deal with the FARC is having in Congress would mean that probably this creates some pressure on the ELN leaders in order to release this guy and start the negotiation in the coming weeks. Because the feeling amongst people in Colombia, in particular left-wing leaders, is that the armed struggle is not any longer sustainable in Colombia. So I believe that this would create a good precedent for the ELN to start moving quicker in terms of getting a peace deal with the government.
Now, on the subject of the vote itself, opponents of the peace deal, specifically Álvaro Uribe, are crying foul over the fact that this will be decided by politicians, by lawmakers, rather than by voters. However, I mean, is that perhaps a bit of a convenient diversion, given that a second referendum in which large swathes of rural Colombia would not be paralysed by Hurricane Matthew, for example, would most likely probably yield a yes vote?
Well, actually, I think the decision of the government and the reason why we are in this particular situation in which Congress is the one deciding the, you know, doing the referendum is because the bilateral ceasefire is very weak. We are in a really dangerous zone in this moment, and I think the government and the FARC, knowing that there is a really serious change of the peace deal breaking through, they have decided that they need to go to Congress because it would be the quickest mechanism in order to get the peace deal moving and start the implementation. I think Álvaro Uribe is playing his cards in the way of saying, you know, you need to ask people again, because on the 2nd of October, people were asked and they actually rejected the peace deal.
Do you think in reality, though, that Uribe would actually want a second referendum, given that it could actually be quite embarrassing?
No, well, actually, I do think that he would like a second referendum because he thinks that this is a way in order to get his political campaign moving. You know, what he's been doing for the last 3 or 4 months and since August this year is just putting together all the pieces in the puzzle in order to be ready for 2018 elections. And I believe that a second referendum, even though if he doesn't win, it would allow him to strengthen the voters. It would strengthen his position vis-a-vis his voters in the regions. And I think that's an important thing that, you know, for him is part of the strategy. Absolutely.
So this
he's not worried about that.
So this is as much about politics in Colombia ahead of the peace process as it is the actual peace process itself.
Well, I think there are things that need to be considered here. The first one, yeah, it is mainly about 2018 elections, because President Santos cannot go for presidency again. And then Centro Democrático is really trying to get back the presidency into 2018. I think that's one part of it. But the other part of it is that the special jurisdiction for peace is a really threatening mechanism for Uribe and some sectors of the rural elites in Colombia, because they will have to actually go to a special tribunal and there would be a mechanism in order to know what happened in the past, and they would probably have to end up accepting responsibility for wrongdoings of the past. Something that Uribe is not willing to do because he believes that he has moral stand above Colombians because he's been one of the most successful presidents in recent history in Colombia, and he doesn't want his legitimacy to go away because he goes to a special tribunal to accept his wrongdoings, the wrongdoings of the past. So I think those are the two main elements that actually make Uribe and his supporters campaign against the peace deal with the FARC, because it's not only about demobilizing the FARC, but it's actually the state and political elites in Colombia accepting responsibility for the wrongdoings of the past.
Well, Andrea Gomez Suarez, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for your call.
MPs in the British Parliament are today debating what Tony Blair told Westminster in the run-up to the Iraq War. The Scottish National Party is calling for an investigation into, quote, misleading information presented by the former Prime Minister Tony Blair in the build-up to the 2003 invasion. It says that the Commons debate is designed to prevent any repetition of the disastrous series of events that led to the invasion.
In addition, the motion calls on the Commons Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee to investigate the difference between private and public policy. One of the main critics of Blair, and indeed the Iraq War itself, has been former MP George Galloway. Liam O'Hare spoke to him earlier.
It's SNP MP and former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond who is leading today's debate. He says that the Iraq inquiry, led by Sir John Chilcot, provided substantial evidence that Blair misled Parliament on the government's policy towards the Iraq invasion of 2003. The inquiry found that Blair had overstated the threat posed by Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and had made wholly inadequate plans for the aftermath of war. It also released a memorandum from Blair to then-US President George Bush, saying that he would be with him, whatever. Well, George Galloway was an outspoken opponent of the war and has led the calls for Tony Blair to be jailed for his role in it. I asked him if today's parliamentary debate was of substance or was purely a symbolic move.
Well, it could have been more substantial if the Labour Party had had the good sense to get behind it, but as they haven't, then it will be merely symbolic. But that doesn't mean it's unimportant. If lying to Parliament, systematically misleading, even deceiving Parliament, doesn't mean anything anymore, then heaven help us so far as parliamentary democracy is concerned. It's extremely discrediting that the Chilcot report, millions of words, millions of pounds, 8 years in the cooking, is just left on the shelf to gather dust, and the British Parliament, the British state, does nothing to hold to account the people who are indicted therein. And Alex Salmond deserves all praise, not just for being the driving force behind this motion, but for his entire conduct in the run-up to the war and since the war. I have many political disagreements, as you know, with the SNP, but Alex Salmond in particular has played a captain's innings.
And of course, this comes at a time where just last week Tony Blair announced that he is seeking to return to frontline politics or to the centre of political life. Do you think he's got any hope of achieving that?
Well, that's what makes the Labour Party's decisions about tonight all the more lamentable, because if they don't stop Tony Blair's comeback, Tony Blair will be the end of them. And this was the moment to do it. And I am afraid he does have a chance. He's chosen his terrain very carefully and quite smartly. He knows that there's a huge swathe of the British ruling class, almost all of it, in fact, finance capital, all the captains of industry, most of the newspapers, the BBC, the civil service, the deep state, are all against Brexit. So Blair wants to be their leader, which puts him potentially at the head of quite a substantial army and a very well-financed one. So it's a clear and present danger, to use language that he used falsely during the run-up to the war. And so I'm concerned about it, yes.
And what does this say about the fight that Jeremy Corbyn still has on his hands in the Labour Party? Like yourself, Jeremy Corbyn has been one of Tony Blair's most fervent opponents for many years, yet it's reported that he will not even attend the debate today. Is he still fighting, waging a war against the Blairites, essentially?
Well, I'm afraid it's the only calibration you can make is that he has found himself in too weak a position inside the Parliamentary Labour Party to even turn up for the debate, let alone vote for the motion, which he indicated over the summer that he would vote for it. So it demonstrates the very perilous situation that he is in. He is the leader of hundreds of thousands of Labour Party members, but he's the leader of only a dozen or two Labour members of Parliament. And so I feel very sorry. I know after close relationship with him for almost 40 years, I know how he'll be feeling about having to stay away from the debate this evening.
And just lastly, George, I believe you're touring Ireland just now, promoting a film about Tony Blair himself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Yes, my film, The Killings of Tony Blair, is available everywhere now on Amazon, iTunes, HMV, and so on, and also in cinemas and halls at this moment all over Ireland. I was in Derry, Belfast, South Armagh, and now I'm on my way to Dublin. So it's quite topical, the film, but then, you know, you could make a film about Tony Blair and it will always be topical because he's in the news every day, rubbing our noses in his return, in his financial success, and in the fact that substantial sections of the British establishment still look to him as a leading figure, as a lodestar. So the film is packing in big audiences. In fact, the Belfast audience was the biggest anywhere in the world to date. So I don't think this film, or me for that matter, are going out of business anytime soon, because Tony Blair, I'm afraid, like the bad penny, proverbially, keeps turning up.
George Galloway, brilliant to get your thoughts today. Thanks for joining us in World in Focus.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, tensions remain high among the senior leadership of the African National Congress after their National Executive Committee rejected calls for President Jacob Zuma to stand down as the South African president. But serious questions remain over Zuma's leadership, as Professor Tom Lodge from Limerick University tells us in just a moment.
As the Obama administration and Russian officials stand at odds over Syria, the United States has announced its plans to provide the Afghan Air Force with new attack helicopters, undermining what has traditionally been a Russian market for helicopters.
Violent scenes in Haiti as banana exporter and political newcomer Jovenel Moïse wins the presidency amid claims of foul play and electoral coups. We'll be looking at who the controversial new Haitian president is and what it means for Haiti.
The African National Congress has dominated South African politics for 22 years after apartheid came to an end in 1994. Although the party has experienced multiple crises during that period, serious concerns have been raised in recent months that the ANC may be headed for electoral defeat in national elections scheduled for 2019 unless it replaces its leader, the South African president, Jacob Zuma.
Despite the party's ruling National Executive Committee rejecting a motion calling for Zuma to quit, the internal crisis facing the ANC is not likely to go away. Our reporter Mark Hurst has this report.
The National Executive Committee of the African National Congress has rejected what it described as a negative narrative over the leadership of the South African President Jacob Zuma after he faced calls from senior ANC figures to resign. South African Tourism Minister Derek Hanekom initiated the no-confidence motion against Zuma during an NEC meeting held on Tuesday following weeks of simmering anger among senior ANC figures. Zuma's detractors had called for a special conference to be held to enable the ANC to return to what they believe are the movement's core values, ahead of national elections to be held in 2019. Although the party will now spend an extra day during its policy conference debating the ANC's future, speaking after the NEC meeting, General Secretary Gwede Manteshe said the focus should not be on the leadership, but on the unity of the movement.
The NEC resolved it was more urgent to direct our energies as the ANC in its entirety to working towards unity of the movement.
Joining me now is Tom Lodge, a professor of peace and conflict studies at the University of Limerick, and who previously worked as an academic lecturing in political studies in Pretoria. There has been growing unrest among senior figures in the ANC for some time. Can you tell us what is driving these concerns and whether the problems outlined by Zuma's detractors go beyond his leadership and his presidency?
Yes, the unrest is largely a consequence of discontent within the ANC about the kinds of perceptions of Zuma as a president that are increasingly common amongst ordinary South Africans. Zuma is widely believed to be venal and corrupt, and in particular, criticism of him has focused in recent months around his relationship with one particular family, the Gupta family, who are immigrant Indians, people who have recently fairly arrived from India, and whose businesses are companies that seem to have a particularly favorable set of relationships with government. And the chief proprietor of these businesses. Mr. Gupta himself is a close friend of Mr. Zuma and close to Zuma's family, and has even been accused of advising Zuma on the appointment of ministers. All this is the subject of an extensive report by the Public Protector, which is a kind of ombudsman's body in South Africa. The publication of this research and this report prompted members of Zuma's cabinet to raise the issue of a no-confidence vote in him. It was a discussion, a debate that took place earlier this week at the National Executive Committee of the ANC. It was defeated largely because there are not a significant number of people within the 80-person ANC executive who owe their positions to Zuma and would obviously do badly if he lost his presidency. But the ANC is very worried. The last election results, those in the local government elections earlier this year, for the first time, took the ANC below vote significantly below 60%. The opposition to the ANC, though it doesn't have more than about a quarter of the electorate's votes, is beginning to look increasingly plausible. And so whereas 10 years ago the ANC could talk quite comfortably about being in power in the indefinite future, that's no longer the case.
And despite the NEC's rejection for calls for President Zuma to go, tensions within the ANC are likely to continue, aren't they?
I think they're likely to continue. They're probably focused not so much on any further attempt to depose Mr. Zuma, though of course events could prove me wrong. But the fact of the matter is that at the end of next year, the end of 2017, and within the ANC a year is not a very long time, the movement will organize its quinquennial conference. It holds a big conference every 5 years to adopt and elect a new party leader who will become the new president of South Africa. So that the South African presidency is limited to a two-term period of 10 years. Mr. Zuma is going to go anyway, but it's a question of whether he goes in such a way that he effectively chooses his own successor, or whether his successor will be someone who may be less sympathetic to the kinds of practices that he's instituted and the kinds of people that he's put in positions of authority. And so the succession battle will be a fairly fierce one, and it's likely to be conducted within the ANC over the next year or so.
And the ANC's General Secretary has talked about what he describes as a negative narrative around the speculation around Zuma in recent months. How big an issue has this been for the ANC, and is it a big enough crisis to do lasting serious damage to the party?
Yes, it's doing a great deal of damage, not just to the party, but to the country. For example, a clumsy effort by Mr. Zuma a year ago to replace his Minister of Finance caused a run on the South African currency, the rand, which took another 10% off the value of the currency in global markets.
And how big an influence does Mandela still have on the internal politics of the ANC? And what ways might the two sides attempt to hijack that legacy for their own objectives?
Well, of course, everybody in South Africa, at least most major political figures, will try and cloak themselves in the mantle of Mandela, even people that belong to opposition parties. But Mandela as an active agency, of course, is no longer with us. And Mandela's sort of legitimation functions that he performed, you know, the way that he was able to transcend the specifics of party loyalties and help to create a broad South African patriotism that all South Africans could identify with, that's very much now recalled nostalgically. It's certainly something beyond the competence of Zuma himself, or indeed any of his likely successors.
And finally, it's 22 years since the end of apartheid, yet millions of South Africans still suffer economic apartheid, enduring high levels of poverty and very poor standards of living. Even if the Zuma detractors get their way, how big a challenge would it be for any political party to make life easier for ordinary South Africans?
Look, it really is a challenge. And to be fair to the ANC, they haven't done that badly. It's true that there are still very sharp inequalities, and to an extent those inequalities coincide with racial divisions. But half of South Africa's middle class now is black. That wasn't the case in 1994. And all South Africans are better off than they were in 1994. Levels of poverty have actually reduced somewhat. And most South Africans, if they're not employed, or if they're disabled in some kind of way, or if they're too old to work, are receiving much more generous kinds of state support than was the case before 1994. Indeed, expansion of welfare entitlements over the last few years has been quite extraordinary. The problem of creating jobs is, some people would argue it's a partly self-inflicted one, but it's also a consequence of global developments in the international economy for which the South Africans can only take some responsibility.
Professor Lodge, thanks for joining us on Radio Sputnik today.
Thank you.
The United States currently spends approximately $4 billion per year to fund Afghanistan's military, a figure that is slated to continue until 2017. This week, the United States has said that it would like to replace the Afghan Air Force's fleet of Russian helicopters with the infamous US-made Black Hawk chopper.
Some commentators have argued that this is a sign that the US is slowly trying to uproot Russia's influence in South Asia while its efforts are focused on Syria. Matthew Aiton has this report.
The United States has announced in a new US budget proposal that it wants to replenish Afghanistan's fleet of Russian helicopters with American-made aircraft. Although the Afghan security forces have been heavily trained and are still reliant upon NATO and the United States, it is still struggling to combat the growing Taliban insurgency. However, now the United States Defense Department is requesting funding to update 53 older US military Black Hawk helicopters for the Afghan Air Force, which would be more than enough to replace the current fleet of Russian-designed Mi-17 choppers. Well, joining me now to discuss this in further detail is Omar Samad, a former Afghan diplomat and current CEO of Silk Road Consulting based in Virginia. Omar, thank you for agreeing to talk to us here on Sputnik Radio. US wants to replace Afghanistan's worn fleet of helicopters with the infamous American Black Hawk chopper. Is this just about increasing weapon sales to Afghanistan, do you think, or is there something else going on here?
I think that this is probably an issue that has to do more with technical matters, effectiveness, and long-term sustainability of the Afghan forces. It also obviously has something to do with probably current U.S.-Russian relations. I would say that if you look at the record over the last few years, the Afghan Air Force, which is a young Air Force, after the 2001 changes took place, has had a number of mishaps with some of these helicopters. I'm not exactly, since I'm not a technical person or a military person, I couldn't give you an exact technical answer. But even as of yesterday, we lost one of our best military commanders in northwestern Afghanistan because of a Russian helicopter problem. It seems that and it crash landed and it killed that high-ranking general. Yeah, so I would say that it's mostly because of effectiveness and also probably has to do with ease of maintaining these helicopters over a longer period of time if America or some NATO countries are going to be supplying Afghanistan with some of its weaponry.
Do you think that it's predominantly a technical issue? Because some have argued that it appears the U.S. is trying to bring the Afghan military back within its sphere of influence to increase the Afghan military's reliance on U.S. weapons and decrease it on Russia. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
It hasn't been the case for the past 15 years. America and many other NATO countries, including some people in Afghanistan, have relied and continue to rely on Russian and Eastern European, if you want to call it, production lines that supplied the Afghan army and air force to a large extent, not entirely. This could be just an exception, and I don't think that it's a sphere of influence issue.
What will happen to the current equipment once it has been replaced, do you think? There's always concern, of course, that such unused equipment that sits in a bunker somewhere is always at risk of being seized upon by one or more of the many insurgency groups that operate in Afghanistan. Do you think this is just an exaggeration? Or
no, I don't think anything sits in a bunker in Afghanistan. We are very good at using everything to the last breath. Afghans will continue to use all means available to them. We have a shortage, a huge shortage of weaponry, including Air Force enablers and Air Force equipment that can help us defeat the insurgency, if you want to call it that. We need as many effective pieces of weaponry from anywhere and anyone that we can lay our hands on. But at the same time, we need to be mindful of, as I said, the fact that it has to be sustainable, it has to be effective, and it has to be followed up with training and spare parts and long-term maintenance and making sure that we don't face an issue down the road.
Okay, on a final note, simply because I feel that I must ask, how do you see U.S.-Afghan relations going under President Trump?
I have no idea. I don't think anyone really knows how President-elect Trump and his team, a team that may include some Afghan hands at the end of the day, will deal with Afghanistan's complex issues. What we are hoping, first of all, is that he and his team fully grasp and understand what is going on. Therefore, he needs to consult and engage as many parties
and stakeholders as possible in order to get an accurate reading of what is happening in Afghanistan and not rely everything on just one or two sources or assumptions that may end up being false. Once they do this, then we hope that they understand what is important in terms of Afghanistan's stability, regional security, and global interests. In that case, I am hoping that they will work hand-in-hand with Afghans who mean well and will work hand-in-hand with other countries that also would like to see a stable and secure region and understand where the threats are coming from.
Okay, Omar Samad, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Reports have emerged of violent protests in Haiti after the losing candidates have rejected the preliminary results of the presidential election, which saw Jovenel Moïse elected to the presidency. Moïse took 55.67% of the votes cast on the 20th of November, which means that the result will avoid a second round runoff next year.
With me on the line now is Anthony Stewart from the Haiti Support Group. Thank you for talking to us today, Anthony. Should we be concerned about the legitimacy of these results?
Well, I feel that considering the whole reason for this rerun was because the runoff elections in January were not able to go ahead because the main opposition candidates refused to run in an election against Jovenel Moïse, who's just won these elections without the need for a runoff. It feels very convenient as a result for the party ICN-SECALE, and it seems to me that that negates the trouble that was had in the previous aborted elections at the beginning of the year, and that is to the benefit of all those who opposed the rerun.
Who exactly, then, is Jovenel Moïse?
He's the hand-picked successor of the previous elected president, Michel Martelly, and he's a businessman who runs a notable banana plantation in the north of the country. It's very much pointed outwards of Haiti, very much based on the neoliberal business model that is popular, has been imposed upon Haiti in the last few decades by the United States, by the Organization of American States, the World Bank and the IMF. And Moïse is running, therefore, unsurprisingly, on a platform of low wages, low tariff, export economy that has not benefited the vast majority of the Haitian people for nearly a century and will just continue to depress wages in Haiti. Most Haitians will, following the business model of Jovenel Moïse, will continue to live a precarious existence.
I guess you've kind of answered it there to an extent, but I mean, protesters being repelled by tear gas in poorer areas, reports of gunshots, whilst residents of wealthy suburbs reportedly have been dancing and cheering in the wake of these results. Should it lead us to conclude that Moïse will be president for the wealthy, or is that too simplistic?
I feel that's too simplistic. Unfortunately, the tear gassing of poor areas such as Cité Soleil is nothing new. It's been going on for decades. It's been going on regardless of who the president has been recently. And it's also been followed by MINUSTAH, the so-called UN peacekeeping force. I feel that as well, it's not Party ICN-SECALE has not always been the party of the traditional ruling elite in Haiti. More than anything, I feel that they will benefit, if any Haitian will benefit from this election. It certainly will not be the poorer Haitians. It will certainly not be to the benefit of those who want increased democratization of Haitian affairs. But most importantly, with Party ICN-SECALE, it will be to the benefit of those in the party themselves and those who support the party if Martelly's record is to be continued. And that will suggest the increasing return of those who backed the Duvalier dictatorships of the late 20th century. And as the Haitian army has continued to be rebuilt, we will possibly see a return of military strongmen such as Guy Philippe, which will only destabilize Haitian politics further.
I wonder if I could just finally ask you, you say that the winning candidate, Jovenel Moïse, is a neoliberal candidate, very much in the mold of what's been imposed by countries like the US. But if we take to one side the questions about legitimacy of the election and just look at the
opposition. What was also on offer at these elections?
So the main challenger to Jovenel Moïse was a man called Jules Celestine, who ran on perhaps the more centrist platform. He is the successor, if you will, of President René Préval, who was in charge before Martelly during the Haitian earthquake and its aftermath. And his party tend to follow, say, a less obedient line to those outside of Haiti who wish to impose light industry and low wages, but do not have a particularly radical platform. That's offered more by the next two parties, Petite Dessalines and Famille Lavalin, run on a more traditionally leftist agenda. However, the Famille Lavalin, which was the party of President Aristide, the first truly democratically elected president in Haiti, has itself come under controversy during its time for authoritarian tendencies. But at the same time, they are traditionally the party stood up for those who live in the slum regions of Port-au-Prince and campaign on changing Haiti's relationship with the outside world, the one that benefits Haiti first. I think that both of those parties stand up for the idea of self-determination of smaller nations, and that is in some respects why their vote may have been suppressed by those who do not wish to see that.
And why don't they wish to see that?
It might threaten personal interests and Haiti business interests, for example, but it also, Haiti serves many purposes to many people, as is at the moment, to the elites in Port-au-Prince, to business interests in the wider Caribbean and the USA, and that largely depends on, at this moment, lower wages, low tariffs, and the discouragement of democracy in Haiti. And I feel that, and so long as democracy is being discouraged and continues to be discouraged, then we're unlikely to see any major political change in Haiti.
Well, Anthony Stewart, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, as officials and dignitaries from around the world converge on Cuba, the president of Sinn Féin, the Irish Republican Party, describes the mood in Havana and recalls his previous meetings with Castro, as well as the comparisons between Ireland and Cuba.
And it's St Andrew's Day today, Scotland's national holiday. But why has the projection of the Scottish flag caused such a fuss today? Following a mass rally held last night in Havana to honour the former Cuban president Fidel Castro, dignitaries from around the world are continuing to converge on the Caribbean island ahead of the revolutionary's funeral that will be held on Saturday.
But the death of the 90-year-old Castro has left some nations in a diplomatic quandary over which diplomatic representatives they'll send to Cuba to officially represent them at the ceremony. By contrast, there was little hesitation among Castro's ideological allies, as our reporter Mark Hurst found out.
As Cubans prepare for the funeral on Saturday of their former president, the iconic revolutionary leader Fidel Castro, dignitaries from around the world have been travelling to the Caribbean island to pay their respects. But for those countries opposed to Castro's political values, the question of who will officially attend the funeral has proved a bit of a diplomatic headache. For many others, including the leaders of many socialist countries, the decision to attend was much easier. The Cuban leader inspired, influenced and sought solidarity with a number of other international organisations who he regarded as sharing similar ideological goals to the Cuban communists. One of the movements Castro favoured was Irish republicanism, now headed by Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams. Adams, who met Castro on several occasions, is the only Irish parliamentarian to travel to Cuba to attend the former president's funeral. Earlier, I spoke to him about why he had made the trip to Havana and how Cubans were reacting to the death of their former leader. Gerry Adams, you've just arrived in Cuba. Can you describe what the mood is like on the island and how that contrasts to the last time you visited the country?
Well, I was here last year. I didn't see Fidel that time. Things hadn't much improved since I had been there previously. The rumours or news about the new rapprochement with the US administration under President Obama, the ongoing talks about Colombia and the peace process there, and I participated in that. I met the negotiators that were involved in that. So all in all, the mood was good. Now, the mood now, I was trying to figure out how to describe this to you. It's like a very old and revered member of the family, a very popular member of the family, has just died. And although the news is probably expected, there's still a feeling of sadness, with at the same time a sense, well, you know, we don't live forever. So it's that sort of mix. There is great pride here, certainly with the people that I have been bumping into, and my Spanish isn't great, but and I'm sure there are people here who don't like Fidel at all, but I think most of the people respect him. And when you consider from the time when this was actually a slave state, the national liberation that was achieved in 1959, and then everything that's happened since then, people have a great sense of pride in their internationalism and how they were able to help other people in other parts of the world, how their education system and health systems are second to none. There obviously are issues here, and there, like all societies, there are clearly problems. I was at a big rally, as some locals are saying, there were up to 1 million people in it, in the Square of the Revolution last evening, and it was quite remarkable. The countries and the states and the nations who were represented at that.
And you met Castro during, you know, historic visits to Cuba. I mean, what do you remember most about the president?
Well, I met him a number of times in the course of that visit, informally, if you like, at a public event. And I listened to him speaking, and I enjoyed very much his what we in Ireland would call the crack, the sort of the banter between himself and the crowd. We then had a more formal meeting, which lasted 6 hours, and leaving aside translation times, it was very informative from my point of view. He was very humorous, self-effacing, down to earth, was conversant with the colonial history of Ireland, but the general thrust of all of that. He famously had come out in defence of the hunger strikers in 1981 and also advocated for Irish unity and an end to British rule in Ireland. But he wanted to get below the skin of all of that. He was asking about the unionists. He was asking about the farming industry in Ireland, the fishing industry. We actually don't have a fishing industry. And we also talked about global issues. He said that neoliberalism was the biggest threat to, and climate change were the biggest threats to humanity. We discussed September the 11th, and I remember well that he said that since that event, that no other progressive struggle would be won by armed actions, that they would have to be won by the power of ideas and the mobilizations of people and solidarity between people. He also, and I thought this was almost a humorous little point, that he wanted to know what the Irish language sounded like. And he suggested that I would recite the Hail Mary, Shedda Bahawara, in Irish, and he would recite it in Spanish. So that's what we did. We both prayed the Hail Mary, he in his language and I in my language. And I thought that was a revealing little insight into, you know, an avowed atheist and communist, but it shows you the power of Catholicism that he still knew and remembered the Hail Mary.
And in ideological terms, I mean, how would you describe the similarities between Castro's Cuba and Irish republicanism, especially today?
Well, you know, there is some criticism of the Cuban system, and some may be well enough founded. We actually raised issues about human rights and religious liberties and so on, political prisoners. But all of that has to be seen against the background of the blockade. You know, that this society, this island, people have been basically under siege for 50 years. And while I very much welcome the rapprochement, and I hope that it doesn't get reversed under President Trump, I think it just makes sense to continue to build. Irish republicanism, you know, republicanism is for a republican system of government where the people are sovereign. And I suppose that at its broadest is what our view is. But modern republicanism is based upon the Proclamation of 1916, which goes on to spell out civil and religious liberties and economic rights and social rights. And, you know, it's very, very clear that what the 1916 leaders wanted to see was an Ireland in which people could live together in equality, in fairness and decency. So the phase of struggle we're going through is for national liberation or for freedom. We want to see an end to partition, an end to British rule. We, of course, also want to keep building on the peace process and build relationships with our unionist neighbours as a part of the process of achieving that. So we're in the national freedom or the national liberation, the need for Irish unity fears of the struggle. What the people do after that is a matter for them to decide. I would like to see a socialist republic on the island of Ireland based upon the 1916 proclamation.
And finally, I mean, you attended and were part of the Guard of Honour at Nelson Mandela's funeral in 2013. Are you expecting to take a formal part in the funeral on Saturday? And how have you been received by Cuban officials and the Cuban people generally?
Well, where I'm here as a guest of on the invitation of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba. The international dimension of that was last evening, so I won't be at the funeral on Saturday. I'm returning home. I'm doing meetings here with officials and others within the Cuban administration. We have a good relationship with them. Insofar as, you know, I am recognizable, and clearly I'm not as recognizable here as I would be at home. People generally identify with Ireland, they know about Ireland. There have been, as I've said, long relationships. We're both small islands with powerful neighbours that haven't treated us well. So people, particularly politically tuned in people, would know that and understand that.
Gerry Adams, thanks very much for joining us on Radio Sputnik today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
And finally, today is St. Andrew's Day. It's Scotland's National Day. It's not celebrated that widely, certainly not to the extent of the likes of St. Patrick's Day, but nonetheless, it's a day to celebrate Scotland.
But there has been some controversy today as a Scottish government official said that the Saltire, Scotland's flag, could not be projected onto famous buildings in celebration, not due to any technical reasons, but because it was too political. And we are joined in the studio now by our very own Mark Hurst and Liam O'Hare. Now, Liam, I gather you're not one of those too bothered by the lack of a Saltire on the famous landmarks, are you?
Well, maybe it's the old renowned Scottish cringe, or maybe it's just a sense that there's more important political issues happening at this juncture
in
time. Well, like Brexit, for instance, or like the question of even the Scottish Constitution. And I think when it comes down to it, what flags are on buildings or not is perhaps not the most important thing.
Now, Mark, I've noticed that actually you've come into the studio with a cheat sheet in front of you. Have you got some examples here of political reasons for not putting the Saltire on a building?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the old family motto of mine, which is non quam non paratus, which is never unprepared. So that's why I've come in and put plenty of figures away. It's one of these things, isn't it, that it kind of divides opinion. Some people are very passionate about the flag, and most people, I think, couldn't really be bothered that much. I mean, one of the solutions I thought might be that might appease some of the people who are passionate about the flag is to have the maybe outbid Saudi Arabia to have the highest flagpole in the world. They have one currently, which is 561 feet high. And that way it's so high that, you know, for most people they would miss it. But, you know, you would appease those who really want the Saltire and the highest flag flying position. So I don't know, that's one solution, but I'm sure there's others.
Liam was saying earlier on that he had a solution for the flag, though, anyway.
Well, I actually find the Scottish flag a bit boring, to be honest, in terms of how it exists today. Like, lots of other countries have saltires and things like that. So I think if Scotland were to go independent one day, I think quite a novel idea would be to create a new flag and perhaps something quite eye-catching. And one suggestion I had, I'm not saying it has to be this.
You were quite insistent earlier.
Well, I will be campaigning for it, but would be to do it in the colours of the Neapolitan ice cream, which is obviously pink, yellow and brown. Something for everyone.
You would need a new national anthem for that, though, as well. I mean, would it be an ice cream jingle?
quite possibly, but I think it's a go.
Given the reaction to people being told that they weren't allowed to project the Saltire onto the castle, I would love to see the reaction to your suggestion, Liam, that we just change the flag to some ice cream colours.
Who doesn't like Neapolitan? Surely is.
That's a fine type of ice cream. It should point out, for listeners' sake, that our only English reporter, Matthew Ayton, is stuck behind the glass. He's not allowed in here for this one, for obvious reasons.
It's our day!
But I think that on a semi-serious note, it's interesting that it's very rarely celebrated St. Andrew's Day across Scotland, even today. Perhaps the expats maybe raise a toast, raise a glass of whiskey, but in Scotland itself today, there's really very little celebration. You wouldn't know it was St. Andrew's Day.
Well, if only it was an official holiday, that would be a good thing,
well,
I think.
The thing is, it is. What are we doing here? It's a ruled official holiday by the Scottish Government, yet here we are. But no, you see, St. Patrick's Day, you look at Chicago paints the river green, the entire city of Boston closes down to like celebrate St. Patrick's Day, and you get to St. Andrew's Day, and to be honest, maybe I should be ashamed. I'd completely forgotten it was St. Andrew's Day this morning until I saw these stories.
That's because the salt tire's not been projected onto every building.
That's it. My trip to work this morning, I didn't see a salt tire anywhere.
I should point out as well that I'm just looking on a Google image search of flags being projected on things. And it's happened quite a lot in lots of different countries. I don't understand why it was suddenly...
Well, also, we are allowed to project the Union Jack onto buildings here, which is why that caused quite the stooshy today, is that we're allowed to project the Union Jack, but not the Salt Tower, because it was seen as a political move. However, it's apparently been reversed, and next year, the Scottish Government has said that they can project the Salt Tower onto buildings.
Is there a company that does that kind of thing? There must be someone out there that specialises in flag projecting.
Maybe there's a market for that.
Yeah.
There's a niche there. You can take that in. Yeah. Well, anyway, unfortunately, that is all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus, this special St. Andrew's Day edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is, of course, Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. And in just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. I will not be here with you tomorrow or the next day. I'll be off adventuring, but fear not, Jack Foster will surely still be with you.
So until tomorrow, from Liam and from Mark and from me, but not from Carolyn.
Goodbye.